Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It is always, as I like to say, a pleasure when you come into the house and spend some time with us. Looking forward to a great conversation this week and to really kind of set us off on a number of areas and topics that I think intersect. We've got one hell of a guest. He is the Michael R. Klein Professor at Harvard Law School, at Harvard Law School, as I hear they like to say up at Harvard, where he teaches courses on contracts, criminal law, and the regulation of race relations. He is Professor Randall Kennedy. He served as a law clerk for Judge J. Skelly Wright of the United States Court of Appeals and for Justice Thurgood Marshall of the United States Supreme Court. He's a member of the Bar of the District of Columbia and the Supreme Court of the United States. He's been awarded the 1998 Robert F. Kennedy Book Award for Race, Crime, and the Law, which he writes quite a bit about. And his latest book is what we're going to get into, and I'm really excited about. It's due out in September, so I'm really, really happy to be able to get this sort of lead-in conversation going. It's entitled Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture. Professor Randall, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on.
No, absolutely, man. As I said to you before we started, I've been looking forward to this conversation, going through the book and really appreciating how you've laid it out. So folks can get a feel for the man who we're having a conversation with and the writings and the intellect that he brings to his writings. Just want to give you some of his other books, because after this conversation, I know you're going to want to go pick them up if you haven't already read them. I love the title in this one, and I haven't read it, but I do want to now that I've read this book, Say It Loud. For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law, The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics in the Obama Presidency, Sellout, The Politics of Racial Betrayal, Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. As an adopted person, I'm particularly interested in that discussion. Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, Race, Crime, and the Law. So, Professor Randall, you don't hold back. And in reading Say It Loud, you don't hold back here either. In fact, there is this sense when you go through this book, and you set the tone right out of the gate in the first chapter, where you ask the question, shall we overcome? And you talk about optimism and pessimism and what that means for African-American racial thought. What do you think, given where we are right now, of this idea of overcoming? You know, Dr. King and the movement back in the day talked about we shall overcome. I have been a little bit of a skeptic myself in that regard. I think it requires a work that we really haven't gotten into yet. Maybe we're just starting to get into it a little bit, but it requires a lift. I don't know if the country's ready to make. What's your thought?
Well, I think that many people I know who are thoughtful people are ambivalent. I mean, on the one hand, there is a strong argument for optimism. There's a strong argument for, yes, we shall overcome. I mean, after all, you know, 1865 is not that long ago. Mm-hmm. And in 1865, the overwhelming mass of African Americans were had just been freed from enslavement. I recall in my lifetime, I'll soon be 67 years old. In my lifetime, I saw the end of Jim Crow segregation. I'm from South Carolina. My mother could not go to the University of South Carolina. All my cousins, all my relatives went to South Carolina State. Yep. They couldn't go to the University of South Carolina. Now, you say that's, you know, I mean, there's been just, we could go on and on, enslavement, segregation, lynchings, just one could go on for hours with atrocities. At the same time, it's also the case in my lifetime, for 8 years in recent times, the United States of America was headed by an African American. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama, right. President Barack Obama. As we speak right now, the Vice President of the United States is Kamala Harris,
right?
African American. So, I mean, it's complicated. And, you know, in my own life, one of the reasons why this means so much to me is because people who are very close to me have taken very different positions. My father-in-law, Dr. William Matori, wonderful man, suffered racism, mm-hmm. thoroughgoing optimist, thoroughgoing patriot, ran up the American flag in front of his property every day. At the same time, my father, a great man whom I revere, mm-hmm. Henry H. Kennedy Sr., thoroughgoing pessimist, was not patriotic, never forgave the United States for the crimes of the United States against his people. So, you know, I mean, there's arguments both ways. Frankly, I think that we have to, my own view is to embrace it all. To mm-hmm. embrace it all. It's all part of our reality. And to some extent, you have to make decisions about, well, you know, what do you think? Which of these ways of viewing things do you think is going to produce a better life for yourself and a better life for those who you love, including your children?
Can you say, though, Professor, that, and I love the way you frame the argument, and you in the book talk about how you've pretty much abandoned sort of this sort of not pretense, but this sort of sense everything is all optimistic. You're really mm-hmm. trying to find that balance and recognizing that the pessimism is a big part of the narrative. In fact, you start off very early talking about one of my favorite characters, if you will, in history, Alexis de Tocqueville. Mm-hmm. And you talk about how in Democracy in America, in the book that he wrote, he forecast that the racial, as you say, quote, he forecast the racial oppression of blacks would remain a salient feature of American society even after the abolition of slavery. Yeah. Quote, I do not believe that the white and black races will ever live in any country upon an equal footing, but I believe the difficulty to be still greater in the United States than anywhere else. Damn, if he weren't like spot the hell on. I mean, in this sense of pessimism, as you go on to note, it goes back to almost immediately after, you know, slavery ended. Even the people who freed the slaves were like, okay, well, I don't know how well this is ultimately going to work out.
Listen, in the pessimistic camp, you have some very smart people. The pessimistic camp is in a way the most interesting because mm-hmm. you have people who it's such a wide spectrum. I mean, you mentioned de Tocqueville. Nobody is more pessimistic than de Tocqueville.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But you could also put in there, you know, Thomas Jefferson. You could also put in there Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
You could also put in there Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad. I mean, there it's a Reverend Wright. I mean, it's a very full and interesting an insightful camp. And the tragedy, the great tragedy, is that American history has given them so much to work with.
Right.
I mean, the fact of the matter is, there is a reason why there are really smart people who've, you know, thought a lot, read a lot, looked around the world, who come to the conclusion that, you know, no, we shall not overcome. Now, having said that,
here comes the optimist, folks.
Yes, as you know from having read, you know, there is another camp, and that other camp, I mean, in the 19th century, Frederick Douglass, in the 20th century, Martin Luther King. So, you know, they were insightful too. One thing that I think that I would like for people to draw from this, and that I would like for people to draw from my book, our discussion, just in the few minutes, you know, the beginning of our discussion, shows the breadth and the complexity of thinking within African American circles.
Right.
I think a lot of times people sort of, you know, pick out one person or one idea or one strain of thought and say, well, you know, that's the black way of thinking. No. With respect to every major issue, there is a wide spectrum.
Doesn't that contribute? Because you really tapped on to my next question. What is up with this black-white thing? I've said, you and I are contemporaries. I'm just a few years younger than you are. Mm-hmm. And like you, my mother was born in South Carolina. My roots are in South Carolina on my mother's side. She was born in Columbia. I spent my summers in Orangeburg, spent the summer at my great aunt's house, who literally was about a mile and a half from South Carolina State. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, when we lived near, I think it was their new campus. They built a new campus or got a new facility and just the history there. So you have these layers of complexity that you talk about inside the black community. Is part of this idea of this country's frustration with us, okay, put another way, white America's frustration with black America, is they want to make it simple. They want to dumb it down to some real basic stuff. But as you just noted, within our own community, it's much more complex than that. There is an intellectualization that plays out around race for African Americans. It's not just a reaction to the whip or the enslavement or the Jim Crow laws. There is an intellectualization and understanding and contextualizing the history of that, which is why we're very comfortable with the 1619 Project and understand we're very comfortable with CRT, critical race theory, because it's part of that intellectualization that we have to go through to figure out what the hell is up with these white people and why do they do what they do? Whereas on the other side, that's discounted, it's not even considered. How do we get on that optimistic side? Where you saw the King talking about we shall overcome, you know, the Frederick Douglass talking about, you know, the good nature of white America, you know, trying to get these, and that's Booker T. Washington and you know, Du Bois. That was their debate on how, you know, how do you deal with you know, with white folks? How do you see that? I mean, where does that fit in this struggle of understanding?
Now, a couple things. One, I want to take up for white folks. Just like you cannot simplify or should not simplify black folks,
mm-hmm.
one should not simplify white folks. The fact of the matter is that in American history, yes, you have a long slew of terrible racist, bigoted demagogues, people just terrible, evil, you know, you go on. And then you have a whole bunch of people who have been indifferent, you know, have turned their faces, you know, and didn't step up and try to do something about horrible circumstances. At the same time, let us not forget the William Lloyd Garrisons, mm-hmm. the Jack Greenbergs, mm-hmm. the people who in the 1960s journeyed from their comfortable neighborhoods and went to places where they faced death. And these were white people, and that should not be forgotten. And frankly, I think oftentimes that is forgotten, and it shouldn't be.
Right.
Shouldn't be.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I try to be very careful in discussions like this to not project in that all white people are this way, just like all black people are in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And you do, you're right. I think not just us individually or even collectively, but history itself sometimes forgets those who got outside of their comfort zone, mm-hmm. took the risk to stand with the black community on a number of fronts and in a number of ways to fight for what this country said it was about.
And change. One of the essays in my book, one of the reasons, I mean, I got a lot of pleasure out of putting these essays together. And one of the points of pleasure is that a number of these essays involve people who I knew, mm-hmm. knew quite well. So there's an essay in the book about J. Skelly Wright. Mm-hmm. I clerked for J. Skelly Wright, who's mm-hmm. a judge in the United States Court of Appeals. J. Skelly Wright comes from New Orleans. He is the judge who desegregated the New Orleans school system. In fact, he issued the first enforcement order in the Deep South of Brown versus Board of Education. And he was virtually run out of Louisiana because he did it. Now, when he did that, J. Skelly Wright, frankly, at that point was something of a racist. It was perfectly understandable. I mean, what the heck? He had grown up
in this environment, right?
He'd been socialized in a racist system. Of course, you know, most people would be racist under those circumstances. The remarkable thing about him, though, is he changed. And he changed as an adult and as a successful adult. He changed after having become a big shot in the mm-hmm. American legal system. And, you know, and I applaud him for that. And, you know, people change, people grow. And, you know, we ought to be open to that.
Yeah, so put a pin in that point. Because I think the idea that people change, people grow is valid and true. However, people also regress.
Yes.
People also regress.
Yes.
So I want to, before I get into, because that gets into a discussion around current events that we have experienced going back to George Floyd and his murder, the Black Lives Matter movement, and a host of other things that we see getting played out now, and the rise of Proud Boys and all of that. So, but I want to, before I get to that, because I think this next essay, The Politics of Black Respectability, that you talk about. Oh man, baby, you took me back on that one, because the conversations you had in your household were the conversations I had in mind growing up. And it is how our parents dealt with what was going on outside of the house, yeah. and preparing particularly their young men. Again, this relates to what we're going to talk about next as well. Preparing their kids, particularly their young boys, to go out into the world and to deal with this world. And in this particular essay, I want to pull up where you talk about this. It's one of those. Let me get to 120. I've got my marks here. I'm so excited about this particular discussion, because you go on and you relate to how this idea of Black respectability was something that we as Black, you say, quote, Black respectability politics, has continued to be widely championed. A form of it was certainly propounded by my parents, who inculcated in their three children a sense of racial kinship, such that in our dealings with the white world, we were encouraged to think of ourselves as ambassadors of Blackness. My parents told us that our achievements would advance the race and that our failures would lower it. They insisted that the fulfillment of our racial obligations required that we speak well, dress suitably, and mind our manners. In our household, we felt tremendous pride in the attainments of Blacks. We also took personally their disgrace. When a scandal ensnared a Black lawyer, doctor, or politician, we all felt ashamed, diminished, let down. That was my household as well. My mother, I could show you pictures of how my mother dressed me as a young boy with the fedora, mm-hmm. right? And the suit, the tie, always impeccably dressed, well presented before the world to show my son is not a threat. My son is as smart as, you know, as, mm-hmm. as any other kid. Going through those things, also representing the community. This sense of Black respectability is something very, very important in the Black household. How does that play itself out? How did it play itself out? How does it play itself out now?
You know, first of all, how did it play itself out? Let's go to the civil rights movement. Let's go to, for instance, the Freedom Rides.
Mm-hmm.
James Farmer, when he designed the Freedom Rides, was very attentive to the public presentation of the Freedom Riders. He didn't accept any old body. You couldn't just say, oh, I want to be a part of the Freedom Riders. Oh, no, you had to apply. And you had to promise to abide by certain rules.
Right.
You had to act in a certain way and you had to dress in a certain way. And what he had in mind was, he said, he knew that people were going to get arrested. I mean, that was the whole point, to test Southern segregationist officials and see whether they were going to abide by changes in the law. They knew that some of these officials were going to arrest these people who were mm-hmm. challenging segregation, these great dissidents. And what Farmer wanted, he said, when they get arrested and when their picture is taken, the picture is going to be in their hometown newspapers.
Right.
I want those congregations, I want those relatives to be proud of those people. I don't want them to be pictured in some way where people are going to be, you know, sort of ashamed or, you know, why they want to look like that. Oh, no, no. I want them to be looking in a certain good way. Think about the sit-ins. In the sit-ins, one of my favorite pieces of journalism in the civil rights era comes from a segregationist journalist, James J. Kilpatrick, thoroughgoing segregationist, mm-hmm. racist. He wrote a column about a sit-in, and he said, you know, I went to see one of these sit-ins. I just wanted to see what was going on. And he said it troubled him because he said, sitting in were Black youngsters. They had their books out. They were disciplined. They were, you know, right, doing their homework.
Right, right.
And he said, menacing the Black kids were these white thugs. And he basically ended his column by saying, you know, I really don't like the civil rights protesters. But he basically said, they are much more impressive than my team. And it
right.
bothered him.
Right.
How great. And you know what, this particular essay has given me a lot of problems. A lot of my students over the past few years really take umbrage with my embrace of respectability.
So that's where I was going next, Professor. Let's get into that. Because tell us how do your students react?
What they say, they say, Professor Kennedy, well, you know, with all respect.
Oh hell no!
They think that I am encouraging Thomism. Yep. That's what they really think. When you really get down to it.
Yeah, break it down. That's exactly right.
They don't
right.
really put it in that term.
But they're being respectable, but that's what they mean.
That's right. They're watching my feelings. They don't want to get into my face too much, but that's basically what they're saying. And what I say back to them is, well, hold it. I am urging people to take their cues from, from Medgar Evers, from Martin Luther King Jr. I'm saying take your cues from, Rosa Parks, James Farmer. I say to the students, okay, if you don't want to, embrace my integrationist-minded civil rights protesters, let's look at Malcolm X. Go to YouTube. There are lots of YouTube with him speaking.
Right.
How is he dressed? How does he comport himself? He's forceful. He's telling it like it is as he sees it. He's also coat and tie. As far as I'm concerned, he is practicing a type of respectability politics. And all I mean by that, frankly, is being attentive to the way you are being perceived by other people. And it's not, some of the times the students act as if, sometimes people act as if I'm saying, perform for white people. No. I'm saying present yourself in a way that's going to be attractive, that's going to get you allies from whoever is watching.
Right.
To go back to the Freedom Rides, James Farmer was very concerned with how his Freedom Riders would be perceived by black people. Forget about the white people. Mm-hmm. How are black people going to perceive you, understand you? How are they going to assess you? Are they going to be comfortable with the way in which you comport yourself? Are they going to be inspired by you? Are they going to find you the sort of person that they can invest their trust in? These are the questions that it seems to me are raised by, the discussion of respectability politics. And I will say, I continue to believe. Go down the list: Frederick Douglass, A. Philip Randolph. On down the list, you find people who were very attentive to the way they spoke, the way they dressed,
right,
the way they comported themselves for anybody watching.
So digging in a little bit further to that, because that then is a nice segue into what we see in the modern era. When you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, you look at the protests, the way the protesters are described by certain white individuals and organizations, it does create this tension when it comes to the respectability question. I note what you write in this particular essay. You reference Jason Riley, a black conservative, mm-hmm. I'm familiar with, in his book, Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. You note that Riley describes how he has been repeatedly stopped by the police, right? He believes these officers have racially profiled him, that they have taken his race into account in subjecting him to more intensive surveillance than would befall a white man in like circumstances. Riley, however, steadfastly refuses to chastise the police. Instead, he berates the black criminals who sully the image of the African-American male. In Riley's view, it is they, the quote, bad Negroes, not the police, who have put a target on his back. He enthusiastically echoes the claim of Professor Jerry G. Watts that, quote, racist white cops, however vicious, are ultimately minor irritants when compared to the viciousness of the black gangs and wanton violence, end quote. I have problems with that. Mm-hmm. I know your students would have problems with that, mm-hmm. because that then does that not discount the sometimes inherent attitudes that are brought to policing by certain individuals who already have these predisposed view. I mean, look, I can talk to you about enough white folks that I've met who have had very limited exposure to Black America. And maybe their hook is what they see on television. But there are also other hooks, you know, how they were raised, what they were taught about Black folks versus what we were taught in our homes about white people. Mm-hmm. Be respectful, mind your voice. I'm sure white mamas out there saying that there are such things as Black, you know, respectable Black people back in the day. So how do you reconcile this idea around Black respectability, where the onus seems to be on us to perform at a certain level to appease white wrath and to avoid the billy club of a white officer who is taking out his frustrations or his anger or whatever it is on this well-dressed Black Negro who's driving Mercedes through a neighborhood, mm-hmm. and who's not looking like the thug, but somehow he projects he is the thug? How do you work through that?
I think that this gets back to the very beginning of our conversation. We live in a complicated reality, and there are many important things that are true at the same time. So the problem of bad policing, including racist policing, is a huge problem.
Right.
It is a scandal. It has long been a scandal, and it is altogether good that more and more people are focusing on the scandal of bad policing and other aspects of the administration of criminal law in America that are a problem. That's bad, and that's a threat to any and everyone. Not, by the way, just a threat to people of color. I'm glad that there's been a lot of protests. I think that's altogether good. I think actually there's been too little attention paid to the threat that bad policing poses to white people. You know, there are a lot of white people who are unnecessarily beat up by police, right. Shot by police, incarcerated for too long, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So bad policing is a problem for everyone.
Right.
It's a threat. It's especially a threat to African Americans for the reasons that you stated. Policing has gone arm in arm with racism, unfortunately, over the decades. So, you know, that's true. We have to be attentive to bad policing, racist policing, and push back against it. And that's why I was critical of Mr. Riley on that point. At the same time, we have to recognize that, you know, criminality is also a threat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, this summer, you know, every Monday you listen to the news and what do you hear from, you know, Chicago, from Baltimore, from mm-hmm. Los Angeles, in these poor communities, oftentimes largely minority communities, mm-hmm. where people have been shot, where there has been, you know, arson, where there have been burglaries, where there's been all, you know, assault. That too is a terrible problem, which we have to be attentive to. Now, both of those things are true, and actually they feed on one another. So I think that, you know, I think that with respect to the problems that we face, we have to recognize that there's a complicated reality out there, and we have to be attentive to that complicated reality. It's not going to be just one thing. It's not going to be a silver bullet. We have to be attentive to all these things and be pushing on all these doors at the same time.
We're in a great conversation with Randall Kennedy, the Michael R. Klein Professor of Law at Harvard University School of Law. We're going through essays in his latest book, Say It Loud, on Race, Law, History, and Culture, which comes out in September. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on around us today and how race plays a role in all of that. We'll be right back after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everybody. So glad you are hanging with us in this incredibly important conversation with Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University School of Law. We're talking, Professor, about your latest book, which is due out on September 7th. I've been fortunate enough to get an advanced copy and read it. And I'm telling you, folks, this is an incredible collection of essays and narratives that the good professor has put together that touches on a number of very salient issues in our culture, our politics, our law today. And so I highly recommend when the book comes out, you pick it up. So we're whetting your palate with our discussion as we walk through the essays. So Professor, you talk about a number of things, and where we left off, we were touching on the Black Lives Matter movement and this idea of Black respectability. You also, in the following essay behind respectability, you talk about racial solidarity and this idea of all of us kind of being in this thing together. And you start off referencing my buddy Touré, and his assault on self-appointed identity cops, who write, quote, authenticity violations as if they were working for internal affairs for making sure everyone does Blackness in the right way. Do we, as Black folks, have we, over our 400-year history, gotten in our own way in terms of our progress by self-policing to such an extent that we sometimes give our opponents fodder and narratives that they can use against us?
The answer, short answer, yes. I mean, just like it's often the case that individuals can be their own worst enemies, the same is true of groups. And, you know, in American history, or, you know, in African American history, we've seen over and over again where people, often the people who are claiming, you know, the necessity for solidarity the most, have often been folks who have been the most close-minded and the most willing to be authoritarian. I think of Marcus Garvey versus W.E.B. Du Bois. I mean, Marcus Garvey said the most awful things about Du Bois, and frankly, and Du Bois sometimes, you know, answered back.
I was going to say, responded in kind.
Yeah. Yes, and by the way, it showed both of those figures at their worst. I mean, I really admire the great W.E.B. Du Bois. I mean, fabulous person, fabulous intellectual, but, you know, he said some things about Garvey that were terrible, and Garvey certainly said some things about Du Bois. I mean, this idea that, you know, Garvey basically attacking Du Bois for for being a wanting to be white, allying himself with the white people, being a traitor, being against black people.
Right.
It's ridiculous. But we've seen that over and over, and we need to be very careful about it because, again, the world's a complicated place. No one, I don't care who you are, I don't care how smart you are, no one is going to be able to know everything and see everything in just the right way. We need lots of people with lots of different ideas. Sometimes these ideas will conflict, and we need to be open. Now, there were a good many people who were puzzled by my essay, though, because as you know, I ultimately criticize Touré and others, my friend, Henry Louis Gates Jr., Michael Eric Dyson, because those three were in particular were so angry at the race police. And I had, I felt for them because I get angry at the race police too.
Right.
For instance, people, this has come up. People who, for instance, say, oh no, they cuss out people who use various terms like Negro.
Right.
Colored. you can't say that.
Right.
You can't say that? What, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. You can't say that? What are you talking about? My boss, Thurgood Marshall, one of the reasons why I use the word Negro, I use all these terms. I use various terms. I use Negro, and one of the reasons why I do is because when I worked for Thurgood Marshall in 1983, 1984, Thurgood Marshall said, I use the term Negro. This was Mr. Civil Rights.
Yes.
So, people have different, fashions, different views. Fine. I think
that opens up a very, you just touched on something that for me over many, many years has always been fascinating. And it really kind of speaks to the complexity, but also somewhat of the problem. We are the only group that I can think of in history that has had all these different terms applied to it. And, white folks are white folk. They're Caucasian, they're white, right? Asians are a much more complex because you have different degrees and landmass versus, so it's very different. Someone from Japan is not the same as someone from Pakistan, but it's Asian, right? Mm-hmm. But when it comes to Africa, Africans, we're not referred to as Africans. We're referred to by white appellations that have been placed on us from Negro all the way up to, much harsher terms.
Mm-hmm.
African American, for me, was the first time where we decided to define ourselves in one sense.
No, I think you're wrong on that.
Okay.
Couple points here. Number one, you're right.
I mean, we didn't apply the term Negro to ourselves. That was applied to us, right?
Well,
certainly nigger was not something we woke up and said, let's call ourselves that.
True, but black people.
Black, yeah, that's true.
Have over time. So for instance.
I forgot about the Black Power movement. That's right.
Early on in the 18th century, free black people initially referred to their, various societies, organizations, and used the appellation African, African Burial Society.
Right.
But then they decided, no, we're going to stop that because of the American Colonization Society. There was this society that said, let's send all, let's
ship them all back to Africa.
Let's send them all back to Africa. And, there were free blacks who said, you know what? I want to stay here.
Yeah.
And so let's stop calling ourselves Africans. Let's call ourselves. And they use various terms, sometimes Negro, sometimes colored.
Didn't Du Bois actually he supported the idea of going back, didn't he?
No, Du Bois didn't. There were a whole bunch who did.
Right.
very distinguished people. So, and in fact, some people went and came back.
Right. what is it? Wait a minute. What? No, I think I'll go back.
But I mean, my point is, you know, that there is a reason. There are people, by the way, there's, you know, commentators over the years have expressed a certain amount of impatience with sort of this search for a name.
Right.
And people have asked, well, come in, you know, what's with this? And the way I see it is, you know, Black people in the United States of America have confronted so many different things. It's our search for a name and the complicated nature of our search for a name is really a reflection of the complicated nature of what we have had to confront in America. And so, I don't think it should be a big surprise that there's been, you know, all these different names and this angst. This is just, you know, this is part of what we've faced, and this is part of the way in which we have attempted to deal with our very complicated, you know, reality.
Okay, before I let you scoot, I want to. How do we? Your book walks through a number of realities and truths, in, you know, through the various essays that you set forth. We talked on a few of them: Black respectability, racial solidarity. You also talk about, you know, some of our institutions, like, for example, the Princeton Ultimatum, where, as you note, anti-racism gone awry, and how some of these institutions, in some sense, kind of perpetuate the problem in trying to deal with it and getting us to confront it. Today, I think a lot of that would be labeled or put in the box of wokeness. Mm-hmm. How do you see next steps? How do you see these narratives playing themselves out and the roles that the various institutions, particularly institutions of higher learning, which, you know, at one point in our history, it was like everybody needed a Black studies department, and everybody, you know, and we had to do all these things and go through. And it seems so much window dressing, because a lot of the real hardcore truths and narratives of the lived experience of Black people was not being taught. That then also gets us into the big fight over critical race theory, which you know a lot about, having been a part of teaching that and helping people understand and walk through what that means. How do we not only get these institutions to understand what these things are and what they aren't, but how do we get the broader society to appreciate sometimes the damage that we do when we think we're really woke?
2 points. One, a little while ago, you mentioned retrogression.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to, I think there's a good reason for you to mention retrogression and for us to underline it, because frankly, and this comes through in my book, I've been tremendously saddened. I thought that the country was doing better on the racial front than it is doing. I was surprised and deeply disappointed to see the upsurge in obvious racism,
mm-hmm,
coming from various, you know, parts of American society, coming from the very top.
Right.
I mean, you know, a few years ago, I was basically saying no politician who has national ambitions would dare traffic openly in calls for racism and, you know, racial resentment. I mean, I just thought, you know.
Yeah, no one would do that.
No one would do that. I mean, that's, you know, that's part of our history. But, you know, fortunately, we've gotten past that. Well, I was wrong. Obviously, the Trump era showed that I was wrong.
Right.
So there has been retrogression, point one. Point two, what do we do about it? We have to do lots of different things about it. And, you know, depending on where you're situated, you know, not everybody's situated the same way.
Right.
Not everybody has the same ambitions. If you are in business, there's struggles for you. There's struggles for you in business. If you are in higher education, there's struggles for you. If you are a student, I don't care where you are, you can raise your voice against the various injustices that are confronting our society, including racial injustices. Not just racial injustices against Black people. Black people are catching hell. That's true. We've historically been catching hell, and we're catching hell now. That's true. But we're not the only ones. I mean, you know, the long history of anti-Asian racism in American life. What about the long history of oppression applied against Native Americans that gets, you know, way too little attention? So it's not just Black folks.
Right.
Racism is a problem in American life. We have to be attuned to it. Everybody needs to do their part.
But that's again the central actor in all of that. Or white folks, because it ain't Asians going up against Black folks. It's not Black folks going up against Hispanics. The institutions that support the institution of racism have largely been created and continue to exist the way they do and play out the way they do. Out of this so-called white power structure. So
that's true. No. You're correct. Listen. We still live in a pigmentocracy, and at the the basic force of that pigmentocracy is, you know, white supremacy. It's no accident that I don't care how you cut it in the American socio-political pyramid. Those who are lighter or are perceived to be lighter, generally speaking, do better. The darker you are, the further down you are in the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, has that changed? Yes, it's changed. Thank God. You know, it's changed over time.
Right.
But is that basic pyramid still there? Sociologists have seen this. I mean, in terms of sentencing, in terms of preferences for dating, in terms of preferences, all, you know, for housing, we still live in a society in which basically, you know, the more, you know, the whiter you are, the lighter you are, the more benefits you get. Now, that's, you know, it's a terrible thing, but that's our reality. And so I don't fight you on that.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I still say we do confront a society where there are a wide variety of injustices. I don't want Black people to become narcissistic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want Black people to think, you know, well, it's all about us all the time. And not be attentive to the way in which there are injustices that ensnare other people, including, by the way, white people.
Right.
You know, right. There are poor, bedraggled, marginalized white people in America, and, you know, that's a threat too, and we need to be attentive to, you know, those needs as well.
Well, and I think that, to your earlier point, plays into some of the Trumpian narrative that we've heard over the last 4 or 5 years, sort of tapping into that particular vein of bedraggled, frustrated, they're leaving us behind. Certainly you hear it when you hear some in the white community say, you know, the goal is always to make life better for the next generation. I can't do that. And then they look for the reasons why they can't do that. And so it may be all those Mexicans coming across the border. Mm-hmm. It may be the ascendancy and pushback by Black Lives Matter. It may be, you know, our trade relations with China or some other Asian country that translates into a racial discourse.
You're totally right. I mean, from the get-go, one of the ways in which poor white people have been kept in their place,
right,
was by being fed the poison. Well, you know, you may be indentured, you may be poor, you may be getting a shaft in various ways, but at least you're better than those.
Right. At least you're not black.
You know, and listen,
so true.
That for centuries,
yeah,
has been unfortunately a formula for keeping people in need apart and keeping poor white people in their place with, you know, the mindset, well, you know, I might be poor, but at least I'm white.
Right.
Well, that has been a formula that has led to, you know, the degradation of large swaths of, you know, the American population.
And at the end of the day, it does seem to say that it is as much economics as it is race.
The class question is there, and it has often been obscured,
mm-hmm.
purposefully obscured,
yes,
by the race question.
Because the easier and biggest boogeyman is always the race question.
Oh yeah. Well, just quickly, I know that our time is running out. This, you know, this campaign against, you know, so-called, you know, critical race theory.
Right.
Boogeyman.
Right.
Boogeyman, you know, the many of the people who were, you know, campaigning against critical race, they don't know anything about any critical race.
No.
All they know is let's make a boogeyman out of something that we think is urging, you know, the advancement of people of color, is urging claims of racial justice. We're going to stigmatize that. We're going to claim it's what, Marxist. We're going to claim it's communist. This is an old story, but it's been effective.
It's been an effective story. It's true. It has been a very effective story. Yeah. My conclusion on those who are objecting to critical race theory, which has been around for well over 40 years in the higher echelon of academia, not just in academia, that is a rarefied space of theory and discussion in academia, particularly in the legal space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the fact that these folks are running around talking about, oh, they're trying to teach my sixth grader critical race theory. I'm like, dude, you don't know critical from race from theory. So just shut the hell up and sit down. That actually should be the coda on your series of essays at the end of it. Just shut the hell up and sit down. Professor Randall Kennedy, this was such a treat, such a great conversation. I appreciate you taking time, man, to come by and share insights into your new book, Say It Loud, on Race, Law, History, and Culture. It's due out in September. Please, folks, go to Amazon or wherever you get your books, get an early copy, put in an order for it. There's a lot to learn, appreciate, and understand in the writings of Professor Randall Kennedy.
Listen, thanks so much for having me on. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Absolutely. So that does for this time together, folks. I always appreciate you when you come by and spend some time in my backyard. You know, we got a little cookout going on, a little barbecue, a little something-something. And today, you got a little something-something. We really appreciate it. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And certainly don't forget to do that download thing. You know, I love it when you download. It makes me feel all yummy inside. Give me a 5-star rating if you really like what you're hearing every week. And where can we track you, Professor, on Twitter? You on Twitter?
I'm not really.
You're a smart man. Well, and that's why you're the professor. Well, look for the book, folks. Again, it's Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture. It's coming out in just a couple of weeks. And so we really love you to pick it out and support the intellectual horizon.
Thank you. I could say, you know, if anybody wants to get in touch with me, just go Google my name. The website will come up and my email is right there.
Excellent. Excellent. So there it is. Until next time, folks, you know what I'm going to say. Take care of yourselves, be well, wear the mask, get the vaccine, all right? The sooner we do those last two things, the sooner we get to the first two things, all right? Take care until next time.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.